Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating worldwide. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
The European Union must stand together and united in the face of a Russian attempt to return to the old-fashioned regressive narrative of spheres of influence on our continent.
Welcome to EU Confidential, the number one European politics podcast. I'm Andrew Gray, politics editor at Politico in Brussels. And you just heard David McAllister, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the European Parliament. You'll hear more from him later in the podcast on his recent trip to Ukraine and the role he thinks the EU has to play in this crisis. The shuttle diplomacy this week to try to defuse that crisis is also one of the topics for our podcast panel this week, along with the latest on the French presidential election and in particular Marine Le Pen's campaign for the Élysée Palace. Let's get right to it. Warm welcome to Matt in Berlin. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
And joining us this week, I think a podcast debut for Clea Colcott, our correspondent in Paris. Hi, Clea.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. We'll get to the French presidential campaign in a few moments. But first, let's talk about the story that continues to dominate the news agenda in Europe and beyond, and that's the Ukraine crisis. And let's hear from each of you who had, protagonists in the ring, if you like, this week. Olaf Scholz was in Washington talking to Joe Biden, trying to, I think, as we said last week in the podcast, restore Germany's reputation, which had taken a bit of a beating in Washington over the Ukraine crisis. And Emmanuel Macron was in Moscow and in Kiev. Let's get to Macron in a moment. But Matt, first, what did you make of Scholz in Washington? Did he manage to do some damage repair there?
I think he did, but it, you know, was pretty difficult going in. And I don't think that it could have been fully repaired by anyone, to be honest, because there had been so many mixed signals in the weeks heading up to the meeting. This was one of their first face-to-face meetings, and they don't really have the kind of relationship that Biden had, for example, with Angela Merkel. And Scholz on the international stage also does not enjoy the kind of stature that Merkel does. So I think with all of the wavering Germany has displayed over the past several weeks on Russia, Nord Stream 2, Ukraine, and so forth, in terms of the arms exports, it was a pretty tough task. And it did seem that he was a little bit nervous. There was one awkward moment after Biden was sitting next to him there in this fireplace. It was a very nice setting, and Biden sort of thanked him for coming and did the usual kind of song and dance that he does with visitors. And Biden was clearly finished with his little statement, and there was just silence. And it was sort of Scholz's turn to say something, and Biden had to then sort of signal to him, well, you can start talking now.
To that as well. So welcome, welcome, welcome. The floor is yours, sir, if you wish to say anything.
Yeah. Thank you for having me here, and really I appreciate very much that we have the chance to...
And it showed that he's a little bit unsure of himself in these settings still. But he did speak English, and that's something that his predecessor never did in this kind of a situation. So I think I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, a sort of solid 6.
Okay, I'm sure he'll be pleased to hear that. I was impressed that he not only spoke English, he went on CNN, did a live interview, right, with Jake Tapper, who is not a soft touch, and spoke in English throughout.
And I've heard you refer to this as a strategic ambiguity, but that strategic ambiguity got President Zelensky so angry today, he wouldn't even meet with your foreign minister
I don't know whether this is the truth.
You don't know that? Okay.
She is there. I sent her there. She will go into the front line.
And I think the interesting thing about that was the impression it left back in Germany. That got a lot of attention. And I think people kind of saw that very positively and thought, well, you know, here he is on CNN. CNN is sort of a big deal here, it seems. Although he didn't really say anything that significant, but I guess they like to see the hometown boy on the international stage there. I certainly don't get that kind of feedback whenever I'm on television. So,
right. But the one thing that did get a lot of attention in Germany was where Joe Biden basically said, if Russia attacks Ukraine, Nord Stream 2 won't be happening.
If Russia invades, there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
Now, this is a pipeline project, you know, connecting Russia to Germany. In other words, it's much more Germany's pipeline, if you like, although it's obviously a Gazprom project primarily. But it was quite noticeable that Scholz wouldn't go that far. He wouldn't actually say the words Nord Stream 2 and say it won't happen. And that did seem a bit strange, right? That it was basically the American president saying in front of the German chancellor, your pipeline won't be happening if this happens. And he wasn't willing to either contradict or fully agree.
Yeah, it was kind of a bizarre situation because everyone knows what they're talking about. And it's sort of, you know, the pipeline that shall not be named, the Voldemort pipeline, as it were. And it's not really clear to me still what Scholz was trying to signal with that, if he is trying to sort of keep Putin on his toes and thinks that by not sort of showing his cards, you know, that's a better strategy than coming straight out and agreeing with Biden. So I think, again, this is a sign that he is not as sure-footed, you know, in these situations maybe as his predecessor was.
Right, who had 16 years of practice, if you like. I mean, this, I do think it's always interesting, I think, to see politicians, even very experienced ones who've held very senior jobs, but not the top job, that that's still quite a jump, right? It doesn't matter if you've been vice president or finance minister or mayor of Hamburg or whatever it is. When you're front and center, even for people as experienced as Scholz, it's actually quite a steep learning curve. Clea, let's switch to you. Emmanuel Macron in Moscow and then in Kiev had this face-to-face meeting with Vladimir Putin. I think 5 hours of talks sitting at either ends of a very long table, which launched a million GIFs and memes and other things on Twitter. But obviously very serious situation and in some ways, you know, going into the lion's den, if you like, Emmanuel Macron in this situation. What did you make of how he did? And also, how was it portrayed and received in France, this kind of peace mission that Macron had kind of taken it upon himself to undertake?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is they come away, Putin and Macron, saying different things about what was agreed during those 5 hours of talks. 5 hours during which Putin says that Macron was torturing him, you know, keep coming back. And Macron can definitely go on for hours and hours, as we in the press corps know. It's still unclear whether in the long run this will have an impact or whether or not it just signals disunity in the sort of Western camp. I mean, but from the perspective of the French press, it's true that it is seen as, I mean, his mission is seen as a partial success, you know. He went over there, and there's this sort of idea in France that, you know, you've got to try the diplomatic route, it's always good, and it's a role that French presidents can and have undertaken in the past, and it's not out of character for Macron to, you know, fly over to Russia and speak to Putin and fly to Ukraine, and then, you know, that is all seen as something that the French actually value. Whereas I think there's much more probing questions as to what and whether it has a negative effect on, you know, relations with Putin to have Macron go in there and say things like, oh, we've got to understand the trauma of the Russian people.
Yeah, and there's obviously a lot of nervousness, particularly in Eastern Europe, with people wondering what Macron might be willing to give away without, you know, their agreement. And so you certainly saw some of that nervousness, I think, in some of the commentary around this visit. And I feel like we have to distinguish between some of the communication around it, which seemed very messy. You know, he gave an interview to a French newspaper, the Journal du Dimanche, about this mission, which then there was all sorts of dispute and argument about what exactly he'd meant and what exactly he'd said, because of course it was in French, whereas if this had been given to a kind of international audience, there might have been a bit more clarity there. And then, as you say, Clea, we had all these disputes about whether he'd got agreement. First of all, that there wouldn't be any military escalation, and also on whether the Russian troops that are in Belarus, purportedly for an exercise, will be returning to Russia when that exercise ends. And the Kremlin was saying, well, we'd always said, nobody had ever said they would stay, so that's not a concession. We haven't agreed to anything that wasn't previously already decided. So the communications around it all look quite messy. What we don't really know, of course, is what was discussed behind closed doors and whether there is some plan in the works that might, you know, lead to a de-escalation. Matt?
I don't think it really matters that there is all of this miscommunication at the moment. I think that's actually part of the plan, at least part of Putin's plan. And, you know, as Clea said, it's very important for Macron to show the French that he's there as a, you know, statesman and is trying to kind of make the best of a bad situation. That's very much the German approach as well. And I think Scholz is going to be traveling to Moscow next week. And it seems to me the strategy really is to just keep Putin talking and to just keep the ball rolling and to have this...
Well, to be fair, there would be nobody better than Macron for that.
And to have this kind of parade of officials go not just to Moscow, but also to Ukraine. I mean, we've seen pretty much every foreign minister, it feels like, fly into Kiev. And this week, Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, traveled to the front there in Donbass. So, you know, it makes it kind of awkward, I guess, for the Russians as well to invade when, you know, these ministers are there, although I wouldn't necessarily put that past Putin. But it seems to me, though, that the other lesson of this week is that at the end of the day, and obviously I'm biased on this and all my European friends are going to hate me for saying it, but it's sort of the lesson of the Scholz trip in particular was that, you know, despite all of this noise in Europe, at the end of the day, this is going to be decided by Washington and Moscow, and that everything else around it is just kind of white noise. And I thought it was interesting the way that, you know, Biden kind of called Germany to heel here, basically. And for all of the talk also in Washington about including the Europeans, and they are including the Europeans, but, you know, ultimately this is going to be decided between Putin and Biden.
Let's switch topics for a bit. We'll come back to Ukraine later with our guest, David McAllister. But Clea, while we have you, we wanted to get an update on the French presidential election, the campaign. It's all not far away now. The election itself is only a little over 2 months away. Although Emmanuel Macron, bizarrely, I would say, just looking from this distance, has not actually declared that he's a candidate for re-election yet. But everybody assumes that he's going to do that. We know a website's been built, and at some point an announcement will come. So just looking at our political poll of polls just now, just to get an overview of the race, it almost looks like there's two elections, really, like there's an election within an election, because Macron right now looks nailed on to make it to the second round. He's on 24%. So in a sense, that first race for him is run, unless, you know, something dramatic happens in the next couple of months. So there's this kind of second election going on, I would say, a kind of election within an election to determine who gets second place, which will get you into that second round runoff against Macron, who, of course, is supported by his own centrist party, La République En Marche. And in that election within an election, it looks pretty tight. Marine Le Pen, the candidate of the far-right National Rally, is at 17%. After her, Valérie Pécresse of the conservative Les Républicains on 16%. And then comes the upstart far-right candidate, if you like, Éric Zemmour, on 14%. And then the far-left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, is at 10%. So, Clea, you've been focusing on Marine Le Pen. Give us a sense of the messages coming out of her campaign. How has it differed from last time when, of course, she did make the second round and face off against Emmanuel Macron? And also, how is she close up? Because I know you've been at a rally of hers recently.
Yeah, I was at a rally of hers this weekend. And
is she even nicer in person?
I'd say that she has an attitude that is, she doesn't impose too much distance with others. She can talk in what appears to be quite casual tones. I mean, when you're part of the press group that follows her around, she sort of meets up with the press and she's there tugging away on her electric cigarette and giving you and almost joking about French politics. Of course, she's much more jolly when she's up in the polls. And right now, it's a little bit tricky. You know, Éric Zemmour is coming back up the polls. So I must say that last time we saw her at the rally, she was not smiling. What I'd say as well is that, I mean, she's running a campaign that's very different to 2017. It's almost, she's trying to play the Mutti card, like, you know, the German Angela Merkel, the mother who will protect the French blue-collar workers against globalization, who will protect you against, the influx of immigrants. You know, that's she's very much playing a much more sort of personal campaign. Now, whether this is actually successful is the big question, because, I mean, obviously she's trying to reach out to voters beyond her base. And I must tell you, when I was at the rally, I found that it was a bit limp. You didn't have, having done 2017, you didn't have that same excitement behind Marine Le Pen, which was, oh my God, she's going to get through to the second round. Oh my God, she's got momentum behind her. It felt quite unenthusiastic. I mean, people were there, and the people who were there were very staunchly supportive of Marine Le Pen, but they'd all been bussed in from the four corners of France, which is not the same dynamic that you're seeing in Éric Zemmour's rallies, even though he is polling below her. So, you know, it's not looking very good for Marine Le Pen.
Where was it, the rally?
It was in Reims,
okay.
Which is sort of 1-2 hours out of Paris.
And was it a big thing, thousands of people, or fairly kind of low-key?
It was quite a big thing. It was 3,000-4,000 people. And so you had food stalls from the different regions. You had a band. It was, quite jolly, and everybody, because, sometimes the press can be not very welcomed in these kind of things. But there was no animosity, no hostility, everybody well-behaved, which is a very different vibe from what you're getting at the moment from far-right Éric Zemmour, who's very divisive, very controversial, and gets people's backs up, but also sort of in a way is the sort of thing that's struck people in this presidential election.
Right. He's the novelty and the one who's kind of firing people up.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And maybe just finally, how is Marine Le Pen tackling Europe and the EU in this campaign? I mean, last time I think she was pretty much advocating France getting out of the euro. She's certainly hinted at that in the past. And obviously it's part of this rebrand that she seems to have done, changing the name of the party, trying to broaden the base. It seems to me, anyway, from this distance, but you tell us, that she's also toned down the anti-EU rhetoric. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's really interesting is one person from the National Rally was telling me today that, oh, it's interesting, we are to the left of Michel Barnier now when it comes to Europe, which I thought was quite funny. I mean, basically, they've rowed back on a lot of things. So they no longer want to leave the euro. They no longer want to leave Schengen. They no longer want to leave the European Court of Human Rights. And they justify it by saying that Europe has changed. So Europe has understood that basically it can't take all the powers away from nation states, that it, that sovereignty has to be returned. But, beyond that, beyond saying, oh, Europe has changed, it's very difficult for her to be convincing on Europe. So, I mean, it's something that she generally tries not to talk about.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Clea, Matt, thanks very much.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
And Matt, Clea and I will be back later in the episode with some recommendations for reading, watching or listening. Now, right after this short break, David McAllister, Chair of the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, on his recent trip to Ukraine and on how he thinks Europe should handle this crisis.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A message from Meta.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Now we'll turn to a conversation I had this week with David McAllister. He's a member of the European Parliament, chairs the Committee on Foreign Affairs there. He hails from Germany, although I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that his father was from Glasgow, which is why he's blessed with such a fine accent when he speaks English. McAllister is a member of Germany's centre-right Christian Democrats, the CDU, that's part of the European People's Party group in the European Parliament. And I started by asking him for his overriding impressions of that recent trip to Ukraine that he took as part of a European Parliament delegation.
My impression was in Mariupol that people in eastern Ukraine are very concerned about the situation, yet the atmosphere is calm. There are no signs of panic, so people are remarkably calm. They are trying to live their normal lives despite this difficult situation, and they are also determined. And what we also notice, as all other visitors who go to the contact line, every week, despite the ceasefire, military confrontations continue along the contact line. And we were, for instance, informed as we visited a Ukrainian military base since the last ceasefire in 2020, every week in 2021, people were killed, civilians and non-civilians. So these are my impressions. The people are calm, they are determined, they are concerned, and people in Ukraine are facing every week Russian attempts to destabilize the country economically, politically, through cyber attacks, disinformation, fake news, threatening, and many other examples.
Mm. And what particularly for the ordinary people that you met, the politicians that you met, what do they want from the European Union? And how is the European Union doing in terms of, you know, giving them what they want?
Well, the people we spoke to, the normal people in Zaporizhia and Mariupol, but also the high-level politicians in Kiev, everyone we spoke to was very, very thankful for our visit. It is very, very helpful that in these hours of some uncertainty, visitors actually come to Ukraine and to show support and solidarity. Every person I met is hoping, praying for a diplomatic, peaceful solution of this conflict. And what Ukrainians are asking for is solidarity from the European Union and the whole political West, including the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom, just to name three non-EU partners. And it is not only about showing solidarity and sympathy, it's also about showing concrete support on the ground. And while we were in Ukraine, Vice President Valdis Dombrovskis was also in town to present the new 1.2 billion euro macro financial assistance package.
And in terms of the European Parliament's role specifically, I mean, how much of a role can the Parliament play? I believe you've got some suggestions about what the Parliament could do in this situation. I mean, can it play a meaningful role when it gets to a big geopolitical crisis like this?
This crisis has to be solved diplomatically, and I welcome all the activities which are being undertaken in this moment to de-escalate. And I also welcome all the different formats which are being used to talk to the Ukrainian side, but also to the Russian side. One thing is important. The European Union must stand together and united in the face of a Russian attempt to return to the old-fashioned regressive narrative of spheres of influence on our continent. This is more than a conflict between Russia and Ukraine. This is questioning the whole peace and security architecture in Europe. And this is why this also matters to all of us in the European Union and in the whole of Europe. So the first thing is that we are united and that the free European institutions are united. And what I found remarkable about our trip to Kiev was we had colleagues from six of the seven political groups with very different views on so many, many policy issues. But here, it was a clear messaging that the European Parliament stands united. Now, Andrew, you're asking me, what can we do now? I had the opportunity to present, together with Nathalie Loiseau, who co-chaired our trip to Ukraine, some suggestions for a number of parliamentary activities. This includes debates in the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Subcommittee on Security and Defence. We could look at having joint meetings of our committees in the European Parliament and the Verkhovna Rada, the Ukrainian Parliament. There are many, many other things we could do. And finally, while we were in Kiev, we handed over an invitation of the newly elected President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, to President Zelensky, on the one hand, to address the European Parliament, and also we handed over the invitation to the Speaker of the Verkhovna Rada, Ruslan Stefanchuk.
As a senior German politician, albeit your party is not in power at the moment at the federal level, but I wonder how you feel about some of the criticism that's been levelled at Germany and its response to this crisis. You know, the two perhaps most specific points would be Germany declining to deliver defensive weapons to Ukraine, and also the question of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, how much that should be on the table in terms of sanctions. Are you concerned about damage to Germany's international reputation? Do you feel that the positions of the current government make sense from your point of view?
Andrew, as you mentioned, I am now a member of a party that's in opposition in Berlin. That's something new we Christian Democrats still have to get used to after 16 years in power in Germany. And it would be a very easy thing now for me to criticise the German government. But I'll tell you, I believe a lot of criticism towards Germany is unfair. Germany is the biggest financial supporter for Ukraine. We have done a lot. We will continue to do a lot. Our foreign minister from the Green Party, Annalena Baerbock, just went to not only Kiev, but also to eastern Ukraine, to the contact line, to show support and solidarity. What I would say is that any German activity needs to be closely coordinated with our European partners and with our NATO allies. And yes, the newly elected Chancellor Olaf Scholz was astonishingly silent for a couple of weeks. But now he started to become more active. I welcomed that he finally found the time to visit Washington. But the joint press conference with Mr. Biden showed that there's a lot of coherence between the American and the German position. Chancellor Scholz, obviously, in Washington was visibly eager to demonstrate unity and determination. But perhaps some critics might be right in saying that he missed an opportunity to settle doubts on all the German government's positions towards the Kremlin. But even if I don't share all the criticism, I did notice that the attitude of the German government in the last days and weeks has caused and created quite some criticism, doubting the loyalty and reliability of Germany. And whatever we do is we have to be crystal clear that we are absolutely united with our partners and allies. Now, the one point you mentioned is Nord Stream 2. I think one thing must be clear. If there is any further military aggression against Ukraine from Russia, Nord Stream 2 simply cannot go forward. We have to be very clear here. Whether Nord Stream 2, what will happen with this project? Well, it depends very much on developments in the Kremlin. It is certainly becoming increasingly clear that the geopolitical implications of this project were totally underestimated at the beginning of the project. And I can tell you, Andrew, as a German member of the European Parliament, I know that there are very different views on this project here in Brussels. And I'm also aware that the European Parliament at several occasions has voted with quite broad majorities against Nord Stream 2.
Let us end, if you just have one more moment, on a lighter note. We like to ask our guests to recommend something, especially when so many of us have been locked down or in self-isolation. Might be a book you've read or a movie or a podcast. And either something you've enjoyed recently or something you kind of always recommend to people as an all-time favourite. Anything spring to mind?
Well, as all people, I was pretty much shocked at the beginning of the pandemic that all of a sudden we were at home, we had time, no meetings. Thanks to my teenage daughters, I was introduced to the world of Netflix. But I must say, after 2 or 3 weeks, I found it a bit boring. And I actually started doing something which I hadn't been doing for 20 years. I started to exercise. I think I last went running when I was still in the German military 30 years ago. So I slowly started exercising again, running a little longer, every day a little more. And actually, I've kept this now that I try to exercise at the weekends when I'm at home in Germany. I've lost a bit of weight and I simply feel better. And this is something which I probably would never have started without being forced to just simply stay at home and not be able to attend political meetings due to the pandemic.
There we go. So every cloud is a silver lining. Okay, that's a good tip and one that I should definitely follow. I have some lockdown kilos to lose. David McAllister, we'll let you get to your next meeting. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Andrew. All the best.
David McAllister putting us all to shame there by using lockdown to get fit. But now for some recommendations from those of us who've spent more time slouching on the sofa than pounding the pavements. Clea, what's your recommendation?
At the moment, I'm reading the Solitaire du Palais, which is the Solitary Man of the Palace, which is all about Macron, and which is quite a good read if you want to go through the whole 2017 to 2022. And in it, there's one of the first scenes of Macron's presidency in 2017. And as one of the first scenes, he invited Putin to go and visit him. And it was, and in the book, it explains that this was one of the moments where Macron was able to project himself as a leader, you know, no longer the young sort of advisor in Hollande's government, but somebody who was on the world stage. And so that he wanted to do this again in 2022 before the election. So that I thought was quite an interesting detail.
Matt, do you have one?
Well, I've been watching Narcos Mexico on Netflix, which I find to be excellent and fascinating, not just because I grew up very near the Mexican border. It basically tracks the genesis of the drug cartels in Mexico going back to the 1970s. It's very well acted with all Mexican actors. And if you watch it and you understand why the war on drugs has not been won.
Okay, I might go for a lighter one after those two rather heavy recommendations. This is very much at the light end of the spectrum. It is comfort viewing. It's a BBC show called The Repair Shop. It's the opposite of any kind of television that involves suspense or tension or jeopardy or conflict or all these things that are meant to be essential ingredients of reality TV. It's basically people bringing in stuff that they want repaired, and it is repaired by experts, craftspeople who bring this stuff back to life. They're often family heirlooms. And basically, this may sound quite dull, but people get very emotional, and part of watching this thing is to try and figure out who's going to break down in tears first, because it's very, very moving as people see these things brought back to life. So there you go, The Repair Shop. All right, Matt, Clea, thanks very much.
Goodbye.
Thanks, bye.
And that's all the time we have on this episode of EU Confidential. Be sure to subscribe or follow the podcast so you never miss an episode. If you like what you hear, tell a friend, tell all your friends. It's the best way for more people to find out about our show and for our community of listeners to grow. Remember, we always appreciate hearing directly from our listeners too. You can get in touch by emailing us. The email address is podcast@politico.eu. I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels. Thanks to Noah Zahn and our executive producer, Christina Gonzalez. And thanks to you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.